Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is the one, the only Coast to Coast AM. Coming to you from the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host and ringmaster of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Yes, we are coming to you live. It's not Memorex. It's not a best of. My apologies for the continuing and very frustrating problems that have knocked me off the air, four times in the past 3 months. A lot of you have written to express your own frustration and to wonder what the heck is going on, and I wish I knew. For the record, I have not been fired or arrested or abducted. I am not being held prisoner by scantily clad Amazonian alien babes from Krypton, which is too bad. The truth is much more mundane, but is all too real, and it's been a recurring pain in the butt. The same problem that popped up back in January has continued to stymie us, and it's a phone company problem. Premier Radio has done everything it can to figure it out and fix it. We've had engineers in L.A. working on it, engineers here in Las Vegas, troubleshooters trying to track it down, and just when we think it's resolved, it pops back up again. So if you think you're frustrated, imagine it from this side. You know, a lot of people at Coast work to put these shows on the air. We line up guests and we study the background material and prepare the interviews, pick the songs, and then bam, the show gets canceled at the last minute because of a problem with the phone line. Take your own frustration, multiply it by 100. And by the way, that is the problem, the phone line. It's not some high-tech whiz-bang brain stumper, just a phone line. It was cut, and then after they tracked it down, they replaced it, and then it happened again. Then there was a problem with programming the phone line to do what they need to do for the radio show. And I don't know what it was after that. And no one else does either. But we're here now, kind of holding our breath, crossing our fingers. But we have a great program lined up for you. Mysteries of the Amazon. Still one of the most dangerous, least explored places on Earth. Coming up in this half hour, the author of a remarkable book called The Lost City of Z. His name is David Gran. And he is an unlikely adventurer, not exactly the outdoors type. But he got caught up in the story of this legendary city of Z, and he tried to recreate the steps of the explorers who had tried to find it 75, 80 years ago, but it disappeared and presumably had died trying. And I think you're really going to enjoy this story and this guest. And then in hours 3 and 4, we'll go on sort of an inner journey with the American who transformed himself into the gringo shaman, using psychoactive plants and healing ceremonies and other exercises in introspection, inner journeys, if you will. And we'll also be joined by one of the gringo shaman's most loyal followers, our friend, fellow Las Vegan, Victoria Alexander, will be here to tell us of her personal experiences with the gringo shaman's magic elixirs. A couple of news items first. The Tea Party kicked off its nationwide tour this weekend, right here in my backyard. They staged a rally in the tiny town of Searchlight, which is about 60 miles south of Las Vegas. It's also the hometown of Majority Leader Senator Harry Reid. And the Tea Partiers made it clear they think it's time for Reid to ride off into the sunset. And I wanted to go down to this event just to see the political theater, the oddity, the spectacle of it all, if nothing else. But when I was told there'd be 10,000 people, but only 24 porta potties, I decided to take a pass. I think a lot of cacti and desert flora got abused this weekend, I suspect. And it turned out to be a peaceful gathering, angry, of course, but peaceful. Some called it the conservative Woodstock, Woodstock without the LSD. I can think of a whole lot of other ways the comparison doesn't work, but there's one similarity. The Max Yazger of this Tea Party event is a guy named T.D. Barnes. He owned the land where this event this weekend was staged. And you might recognize that name, since we had T.D. Barnes on the Coast to Coast program last year. He spent a lot of years working at a little secret base called Area 51. He was a CIA employee. He worked on secret spy planes. T.D. is a fascinating guy who, you know, like many of us, he's kind of ticked off about the national debt. So he offered his land up to the Tea Party for this event right next door to the property owned by Harry Reid. And I mentioned TD also because there's a story we have posted on the website tonight that received a lot of exposure on the internet this weekend. Several of you sent it to me. It's from the Seattle Times, and it's a headline about Area 51. Area 51 workers who are now free to talk about some of the work they did out that base say there were no space aliens at this secret military facility. no space aliens at Area 51. Of course, to my knowledge, no credible person has ever said there were space aliens at Area 51. Some people have come forward to talk about things that look like flying saucers being flown around out there. More importantly, though, the statements by the former Area 51 workers that are making such a big stink this weekend, floating all over the internet, were already made. They were made public 6 years ago in interviews, in fact, interviews that I did. T.D. Barnes was one of those guys, one of the very first Area 51 employees to come forward and talk about the base and what went on out there. And I remember one of the things he had told me back then and many times since is that the people who worked there at Area 51 had no idea what everyone else was working on. Things were so compartmentalized. It's a specific security strategy. I remember him telling me the story. He'd be in the cafeteria where all the guys ate every day, and he'd eat next to these guys, sit at the same table, fill up their trays, see them every single day, and never know years and years later what those guys were working on because of compartmentalization. Need to know. So by all means, read this story. We've posted. We have it on the Coast site, but take it with a grain of salt. As always, Webmaster Lex and I have accumulated an eclectic smattering of news stories and tidbits from various sources over the past week, and they're posted there. In addition to the Area 51 story, two reports about new discoveries of unknown human species, offshoots of our ancestors that died out. There's a pretty weird video sent to me by a listener that looks like it shows some sort of a being floating around, entering a dark bedroom. I'm not sure what to make of it. Maybe you can take a look and tell me what you think. Also, a story, a very serious story from the New York Times about cyber war with China and what the stakes are for our country. And then kind of an odd and disturbing story about a TV news guy, I can relate, TV news guy who's going to be put to death for dabbling in sorcery. I promise I have not tried sorcery, but I'll tell you, if the phone line had gone down again tonight, I might have been willing to give it a go. And with that, I think we're going to take our first break. When we come back, David Gran and the search for the lost city of Z. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Knapp. A couple of months ago, I was reading, I think it was the LA Times, and I read a review of this book called The Lost City of Z. I had never heard about it before, read the review, though, and I just knew it was something that Coast listeners would enjoy and that I'd enjoy reading. One reviewer said of its protagonist, he could outmarch Lara Croft and outthink Indiana Jones. Another wrote, hordes of mosquitoes, poison arrow attacks, bizarre and fatal diseases, spies in starched collars, hidden outposts of Atlantis. What's not to like? The Lost City of Z is like a wonderful 19th century tale of exotic danger, but it goes on to say it's also sheds light on new archaeological research that's exploding our preconceptions of the Amazon and its peoples. David Gran is the writer. David, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on the show tonight.
Hey, I got to tell you, I love this book.
Oh, it's good to hear.
And it's becoming a movie, right?
It's becoming a movie. It was optioned by Brad Pitt's production company, and Brad Pitt is slated to play the main character, this protagonist you described.
I thought he was going to play you.
No, that would be a stretch even for him.
I say this, and you sort of included it in the book. You sort of poke fun at yourself in pointing out that you're an unlikely guy to channel Alan Quatermain or something, right? You're not a big game hunter. You don't go camping. And yet you took the ultimate camping trip, risk your own life. How does a New York writer get so hooked on a story to put everything on the line like that?
Well, yeah, as you describe, and I definitely, as they say in the business, have a face for radio, a body for radio. A little bit pudgy around the middle, a bit out of shape. I suffer from keratoconus, which is a degenerative eye condition that makes me pretty much blind at night. And I tend, as I describe in the book, to get lost even on the subway to work at Times Square. And so the notion of me in the middle of the jungle was about as unlikely as something I never imagined, to be perfectly honest. And when I began looking into this story, I began it much more as a biographical quest, investigating the story of this legendary British explorer, this kind of one of the last great Victorian and Edwardian explorers, who had disappeared in the Amazon in 1925, looking for an ancient city, which he had called somewhat cryptically the City of Z. And it was only as I began to do more research, going around the world, looking in libraries and archives and a forum much more suited for my paltry attributes, physical attributes, that I began to get really consumed with the story. And at one point I had gone to Wales, and I had tracked down Fawcett. That was a British explorer. His name was Percy Harrison Fawcett. I tracked down his granddaughter, and we chatted for a long time. And at one point, she showed me in a back room an old chest, and she opened up the old chest. Inside this old chest were all these old books, and the bindings were breaking apart, and they were covered in dust. They were held together by these little bows and ribbons, and I asked her what they were, and she said, well, those were my grandfather's secret diaries and log books.
Wow.
And these books really held enormous clues both to the mystery of Fawcett's life and to the mystery of his death. And it was really at that point where I decided to do something foolish and head into the jungle myself.
Well, I mean, maybe you didn't know it at the time how lucky it turned out that you were able to convince them to let you see those journals, because as we're going to learn over the course of the next 2 hours, a lot of people tried this same journey and didn't come back. But there were clues in there that maybe this guy, Fawcett, was misleading people in the course of the clues he left behind.
That's right. That's right. Fawcett, he just to give the listeners a little bit of background,
yeah.
he had begun exploring the Amazon in 1906, and he originally went to the Amazon, which was at, back then, and just to give the listeners a sense of its size, it's about the size of the continental United States, this enormous wilderness area. And back then, it was really the last large kind of blank space on the map, at least for outsiders. And Fawcett had been sent in to map the interior, and at that time, the area was so unknown that the countries of Brazil, Peru, and Bolivia, they didn't even know where their borders were in the interior. So they needed someone to come in and survey it. And so Fawcett was given this task. He had trained as a surveyor at the Royal Geographical Society in London. And he was set in. And over the next several years, he mapped this area, and he began to gather clues that led him to believe that the jungle contained this ancient civilization. He found, for example, once in the Bolivian floodplains, he was climbing these large earth mounds, and he saw something sticking out of the ground. And when he bent down, he picked it up. It was a shard of pottery. Now, this was in an era before carbon dating, but it looked very old and very brittle. And when he looked out between these earth mounds, and there were several of them, he saw what he said and described were what he thought were causeways buried underneath the jungle floor. And so he gathered these clues and other clues. And then eventually in 1925, he sent out to find this place. Now, most people thought he was a crank, that he was a lunatic, that the jungle was simply too inhospitable a place to support a complex society, that there could not be a Mayan or an Incan civilization in the middle of the jungle. But he believed he was right, and he set out to find it. He brought with him just two people, his older son, Jack, who was 21, had his 22nd birthday in the jungle, and Jack's best friend, Raleigh Rimel. Off they went. And Fawcett would write dispatches describing his experience as he moved in the jungle, and he would give these pieces of paper to Indian runners who would carry them out of the jungle. And in kind of a very pre-modern form of Twitter, these pieces of paper would be carried from one outpost to another outpost and then typed up on telegraph machines, so that millions of people around the world were following this expedition. And the dispatches emerged for 5 months, and then they ceased.
I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, because I want
sure.
to come back to the archaeological aspects of it and anthropological aspects of it. But
sure.
tell me more about Percy Fawcett, because he was like a rock star, as you describe. I mean, people all over the world were following his exploits. I mean, he was the quintessential explorer, the ramrod spine of an Englishman, stiff
yeah.
upper lip, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, when you look at his picture, I mean, and I have a picture of him in the book. I mean, it's right out of, I mean, you couldn't imagine. I mean, he just fit everything with the mustache and the kind of burning, intense eyes. People said his eyes burned like a visionary. And he was extraordinarily famous in his day. He was an enormous legend. Even before 1925, on this final expedition, stories of his adventures in the jungle had captivated the public's imagination, how he would battle electric eels and piranha and all sorts of predators, how he would emerge from these regions that nobody had come back from with maps. And most particularly about him, he seemed to be able to survive almost any conditions. He was seen as almost indestructible. Indeed, some people even speculated in his day that he was immune to death, because he would go on these expeditions. He would usually take about a dozen men, and usually half his party would die of disease and starvation. And you have to understand that this was in an era, even though it was, just a century ago, but it was an era before all these kind of inoculations. And so yellow fever and malaria, and most of his men would succumb to these diseases, and he would always emerge intact.
And like getting sick out there, as you describe in the book, The Lost City of Z, getting sick out there or breaking your foot or getting bit by a snake, I mean, it's like a death sentence because they
Oh, it
wouldn't
is.
stop. He's on these missions, and if you get sick or you're down, you stay there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there were two things. I mean, one, Fawcett really let nothing stand in his way of his goal or his object. And so he would not let weaker men slow him down. But the other thing was they were in such vast areas that if you became sick or weak, they couldn't carry you out. And if they tried to, it would imperil the whole party. And so his men, before they set out on these expeditions, all agreed to a rule that Fawcett enforced, which is that if you became too weak or sick, you would have to be abandoned in the jungle.
Let's talk about the jungle for a minute because that was really a fascinating part of what you explore in the book, and it's just how stark it is out there, and it sort of goes to the heart of the argument that there could never be a civilization out there, any kind of major civilization, because there's not enough food. It's deceptive in that it's lush and green, and you might think there's all kinds of food and you can live off the land, but as Fawcett and his teams learned, that's very deceptive, dangerously deceptive.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that surprised me when I began doing this research, and it was something I didn't know. I mean, it never occurred to me that starvation would be a major threat in the jungle. You think of this kind of place that's so bountiful, you think of all this flora and fauna. And yet, partly because of the competition for nutrients in the soil among plants, and because of flooding, the soil is often drained of nutrients. And so there are not a lot of crops. And this was one of the theories that led people to think, well, there couldn't be a complex society because there wouldn't be enough food to support a large population, which would be a precursor to any complex society. The other thing that happens is that the animals, the predators in the jungle, are so well adapted to this environment. They have been there for so long that they camouflage themselves, they are more elusive, and that humans, especially humans who have not been in the jungle or lived in the jungle, like these external expeditions that would come in, were simply outmatched. They were simply outwitted, and rather than becoming predators looking for food, they often became prey.
And the descriptions you have, for example, when he goes on this mission to map the one of the borders, Bolivia, Peru, I believe, and you describe what it was like. It was like a wild frontier because they had this rubber boom that was going on out there, and it was lawless, and people would just shoot you down for looking at them the wrong way. In addition to disease and snakes and all kinds of really strange and dangerous creatures that you wouldn't find anywhere else on the planet.
Yeah, I mean, at that point when Fawcett was exploring the Amazon, this is another factor that made it extremely dangerous, was there was this rubber boom. Rubber had become in great demand in industrial countries because of the development of the car and bicycles, and so for tires, Goodrich, Goodyear, and all this kind of stuff. And so Amazon at that point was the one place where rubber came from, and it would be tapped from these trees. But this was very difficult work, and labor supply was often in short. And so rubber barons would send in their men to enslave the Indians, the Native Americans that lived in the wilderness areas. And if they weren't enslaved, they were often massacred. And it was extremely bloody. And Fawcett, even though he had inherited many of the racial prejudice of Victorian society, was appalled by this, that the Indians were treated in this manner. And it also made his work extremely dangerous because of this bloody contact. Many of the tribes became very hostile to anyone who was entering their territories because of the fear and threat. And so this made it very perilous for Fawcett to enter these areas. And one of the things that made Fawcett very unusual for that time period is that unlike these rubber barons or other explorers who came into the area, he refused to let his men fire on the Indians under any circumstances. And I found one of Fawcett's colleagues' diaries in which he described who was with him, a companion, in which he describes how Fawcett ordered his men to literally sing God Save the Queen while he marched forward with his hand above his head into a fusillade of arrows.
David Grand is the author of The Lost City of Z, A Tale of Deadly Obsession in the Amazon, in which he sort of recreates the steps taken by this amazing explorer, Percy Fawcett. When we come back, I want to get into the subject of the Fawcett freaks, because I wasn't exaggerating. This guy Fawcett was sort of a rock star of his time. And then we'll pick up the story of The Lost City of Z, what it really means. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. 85 years ago, an English explorer, sort of the English explorer named Percy Fawcett, led an expedition into the darkest heart of the Amazon, trying to find what he called the Lost City of Z, and he never came out. And in the decades since, a lot of other expeditions have been staged to find out what happened to Fawcett, and a lot of those people didn't come out either. Our guest, David Gran, retraced some of those steps, took that same journey himself, wrote a book about it, The Lost City of Z. When we come back, what is the Lost City of Z, and is it really there? Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Knapp. My guest is David Gran, author of this book, The Lost City of Z. David, before we get into the city itself, tell me a little bit more about Fawcett. I don't want to oversell this, but the guy, he was a major celebrity of his time, right?
Yeah, he really was. He was known as the David Livingston of the Amazon. He later, even before 1925, when he set out for Z, he helped inspire Conan Doyle's novel, The Lost World. In fact, that's how I came across Fawcett's name to begin with and began to look into his story. And he really did. He captivated the imagination. He was kind of the last of this kind of individualist explorer. It was kind of him against the forest. It was kind of, even though it was the early 20th century, it was still essentially pre-modern expeditions where you did not have technology. You did not have ways to kind of communicate out from the Amazon. You did not have any kind of medical protection. In fact, I read many of the manuals that Fawcett had studied to become an explorer, and they would teach you, for example, if you were bitten by a poisonous snake, to take gunpowder, pack it into the wound, and ignite it. Or if you were hit by a poisonous arrow, to take boiling grease and pour it into the wound to help cauterize it. So this was still a very, even though it wasn't that long ago, medical conditions, all these things were still at a very basic level. And so these expeditions really did capture the imagination. It was also the growth of cities everywhere else. And so this idea that there was still this place, this wilderness area that remained unknown, captivated the imagination, and the Amazon in particular.
Yeah, and that people had crazy ideas, like they thought the Amazonians had their heads in their stomachs or something like that?
That's Walter Raleigh. Essentially, from the moment the first conquistadors had arrived in South America in the 1500s, early 1500s, they heard stories about the Amazon, and it captivated their imagination. And of course, the most famous legend of all was of El Dorado, this purportedly city that was so plentiful in gold that the inhabitants ground the metal into powder and anointed their bodies with it so that they were gleaming in the sun.
And Cortez and Pizarro, all those guys went looking for it.
They lusted for gold, the conquistadors, and the soonest they heard a rumor, they quickly rounded up several thousand men. There was 4,000 of them. They enslaved many Indians, and they headed over the Andes, descended into the jungle, and really were not prepared for the conditions. I mean, a lot of the conquistadors wore armor into the jungle, which had to be the most foolish idea possible, and most of them perished. On that first expedition in search for El Dorado, some 4,000 men went, and nearly all of them died of disease and starvation.
And is El Dorado the city of Z? I mean, I know that Z is sort of like Percy Fawcett's shorthand version of his secret name for this city, right?
Yes, and I mean, there is without question a connection. Fawcett, when I described earlier him looking for clues in the jungle, and one of the way he looked for clues to try to figure out could there really be an ancient civilization in the jungle was he actually read a lot of the early chronicles from the first El Dorado hunters. So, for example, on that first expedition of Pizarro and Orellana, a few men made it out, including a priest who wrote an account. And other El Dorado expeditions, usually a few people would make it out, and they would write these chronicles describing what they had seen in these expeditions. And Fawcett studied those chronicles for clues, because even though the chronicles never describe finding this golden city, the first conquistadors into the Amazon had described seeing large populations, seemingly sophisticated societies, roads, bridges, causeways, pottery, things that later explorers who went to the Amazon never saw. And so Fawcett used these chronicles, and they were some of the clues that helped him lead him to this notion that, yes, the jungle really did contain remnants of an ancient civilization.
And is it because of those first explorers that the subsequent explorers didn't find anything? Because the first guys brought diseases and wiped out the...
Yes. I mean, I think that was certainly Fawcett's theory. And I think when we talk a little bit later about could this place exist, I think some of the findings certainly confirm that. And that Fawcett's theory was that disease had helped annihilate large swaths of the populations. And so when explorers came in and didn't see these large populations and they didn't see these societies, they concluded that was the way the jungle really always was. And Fawcett believed that wasn't the case, that they were actually looking at societies that had been devastated from disease. And we could talk a little bit more about that, but other evidence certainly confirms that.
As you start pursuing the story, you go to the Royal Geographic Society, which I tell you, your stuff was really interesting. You could write a whole book about that. I mean, they had the audacious idea that, hey, let's go ahead and map the entire world, and we're going to train guys like Fawcett and send them out to do this work.
Yeah, I mean, who knew that, again, you know, when you begin these projects, and usually when I begin these projects, you know, I knew very little when I began. And so I had no idea that there had actually been what was in effect almost like an explorer school, that people like Fawcett, Livingston, Speke, all these famous explorers, Burton, they would go to the Royal Geographic Society, which was engaged in the 19th century and early 20th century in essentially mapping out the world. And what's amazing is that even in the 19th century, there were large swaths of the planet that had not yet been mapped. I mean, even though the continents were known, parts of the interior, for example, Australia, nobody knew what was in the interior, outsiders, and there was belief that there was maybe a huge enormous lake or body of water in the middle of Australia, which turned out to be false, but all these explorers sent out from the Royal Geographic Society died pursuing it. And people go to the Royal Geographic Society, and part of this was, out of imperialism. The British Empire was expanding. They needed good maps. They were engaged in this project, but there was also a scientific bent to it. There was also scientific curiosity, and they would attract a lot of these explorers, usually people who did not quite fit into Victorian society or were rebelling against the usually very eccentric characters, people like Fawcett and Burton. And off they would go. They would get trained in surveying, and they would also get trained in survival. They would be given some tools, and then they would head off into these very dangerous areas of the world.
As you pick up the story, you go to the Royal Geographic Society, and they let you see some papers, and you go to the Fawcett family, and they let you see some stuff. But everywhere you go, they give you an eye right at first. Aha, you're one of those guys.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I first went to the Royal Geographic Society, they kind of looked at me when I said, yeah, I'd like to see do you have any archives on Fawcett, any letters and correspondence, and look at his old maps. And they kind of cock one eye at me and basically, are you a Fawcett freak? And what I quickly discovered is that there were all these people who had become kind of obsessed to consume with Fawcett, the mystery of what had happened to him and the mystery of the city. And these people would kind of come looking for clues and then head off into the jungle to essentially commit suicide. And so they all gave me these very funny looks when I began this project.
So how many missions were there? I mean, it's sort of like Elvis is still alive. Fawcett might still be alive.
No, very much so. I mean, partly because Fawcett was seen as so indestructible, and I think it was very hard for people to get their mind around, including Fawcett's family and his wife and Fawcett's other two children. He had three children. He took his older son with him, but he had another younger son and a daughter, and he left his wife, Nina, behind. And for the family, they really never gave up hope or pining. I mean, Nina, up until her death in 1953, Fawcett disappeared in 1925. So that's, more than 25 years later, still believe that her husband was alive. She could not believe that this man who she had known so well, who had always seemed so indestructible, could have perished.
So tell me about some of the tell me about some of the other expeditions to find him. How soon after his disappearance did they start, and how long did they last?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things was that Fawcett had warned people not to follow him, and he believed that it was too dangerous and too perilous. And so he really had, before he left, he had said, you know, if I can't make it, nobody can. And he had really tried to discourage any sort of rescue parties. But within a couple years, by 1928, as concerns, and there was all sorts of concerns, you know, were they wounded? You know, had they found Z, they were too happy to come out. Were they kidnapped by a tribe? What was going on? And by 1928, the first large major expedition in search of Fawcett went. It was led by a man named Commander George Dyett. He was part British, part American, lived in New York. And he went to try to find him, took a large party, barely survived. His men did make it out. They were one of the lucky ones. Other parties then continued to go, and many of them disappeared and died of disease. There was a Swiss trapper who believed he had found evidence that Fawcett was being held in captivity by a tribe. He vowed to rescue Fawcett. He took with him a reporter from the UPI and a couple other members, and they were never seen again. There was even a movie star from Hollywood, a guy named Albert de Winton, although that was his stage name, who had made a cameo in King of the Wild. And he really thought he would become this Stanley to his Livingston and find him. And he set off into the jungle. Eventually, a small piece of paper emerged from the jungle, a note from him saying that he had been kidnapped by a tribe. He was never seen again as well. And just to give you some sense about how big this story was in its day. I mean, it was like you were saying, like Elvis, it was like Jimmy Hoffa. If you said, where's Jimmy Hoffa buried? If you said, where's Fawcett buried, for decades, everyone knew what you were talking about. And when that first expedition I described decided to go in 1928, Dyett put in an ad for the paper seeking a volunteer, one extra recruit he needed. And literally tens of thousands of people volunteered to go. I read their letters, which you can find in some of these archives. They came from all walks of life, captains of industries down to butlers, and they all were willing to go on this extraordinarily dangerous expedition.
And so into the breach you go. I mean, you're basically recreating a lot of those steps. You had to know what you were in for.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's amazing and is that these parties that would search for fossils, one of the things that fascinated me was that these fossil freaks weren't just going in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, and 50s. They were going into the present. In fact, a large expedition set out in 1996. A Brazilian financier named James Lynch, who was also an adventurer, he also took with him his son, who was 16 years old at the time, a man named James Lynch Jr. And they went into the jungle, and they were actually captured by a tribe and held in captivity for several days before they were able to escape. And so
you found those guys. You talked to them.
I found those. And initially, you know, I thought, okay, I'll just tell their story, and I'll tell Fawcett's story, and I won't do this myself. But again, as I gathered these more clues, and one of the clues I discovered was when I went to Fawcett's granddaughter's house. Fawcett not only didn't want people to follow him because he was dangerous, he was also afraid in his day of rivals, that one of his rivals might beat him to his discovery. He was very secretive, and he had actually been a British spy before he became an explorer. And he would literally send letters to his wife, Nina, about where he was going in code, and she had a cipher. And one of the few clues to where Fawcett had gone on his last expedition, he was going into the Mato Grosso region, which means dense forest. It was in the Brazilian Amazon. And one of the few clues was a place called Dead Horse Camp, where he had, on an earlier trip, shot one of his pack animals. Now, when I looked in Fawcett's diaries and logbooks, I found coordinates for Dead Horse Camp, but they were different from the coordinates he had released publicly. And what I had discovered, and what the granddaughter confirmed, is that the other coordinates he had released were simply a ruse to throw his rivals off the course. And so I realized that all these expeditions that have been searching for Fawcett often headed in the wrong direction, and fatally in the wrong direction. And so it was when I was armed with these coordinates that I thought, well, if everybody went that way, what if I went this way? And so I decided to go and found a guide, because even though you know, most of the world is now chartered, the Amazon still has pockets that remain unchartered. The Brazilian government estimates in the Brazilian Amazon alone there remain 60 tribes that remain uncontacted. And just a few years ago, members of a nomadic tribe emerged from the Colombian Amazon, saying they were ready to join the modern world, but they were unaware that the Colombia was a country, and they asked if the planes overhead were on these invisible roads. And so there still are areas in the jungle, you know, that are remote and isolated and involve elements that are unknown. So the first thing I had to do and the most important thing was to find a guide who could help me make contact with some of the tribes in the area where I wanted to go.
Actually, before you did that, you had to go shopping, right? You went to
this giant superstore.
That's a hilarious scene in the book. Is you go to this giant camping superstore, Camping R Us in New York, and just buy everything.
That's right, yeah. I mean, as I said, I'm not a camper and not an explorer. And so, you know, under my wife's, you know, forbearance and wisdom said, you know, you're not just going, you got to at least go to one of these stores. And so I went to get every high-tech gadget I could find, from GPSs to, you know, astronaut food, these, you know, ice creams that are, I don't know.
Freeze-dried?
Yeah, freeze-dried. That's it. Thank you. And packed them off with my Swiss Army knife and got everything I could go before I headed. And then I found my guide.
And then you plunge into the wilderness.
That's right. And I tried to follow Fawcett's trail as carefully as possible. Now, I had what I had been doing all for many, many months was gathering all these clues by going to these archives literally around the world and piecing together Fawcett's route as precisely as possible. And with the guide, I followed that route. And headed north into the jungle. Now, we were heading into the Xingu area. Now, and one of the interesting things was I would have Fawcett's dispatches and letters from his last trip, and I would be able to read his descriptions and kind of stay in the same places. And at one point, I knew that Fawcett had stayed on the frontier in a place called Gavo's Ranch. He was kind of, in that day, in 1925, he was a kind of a ruthless frontiersman who had pushed as far out on the frontier before the jungle. And Fawcett had stayed there. Raleigh Rima, who was Jack's best friend, the third companion on the trip, he was already a bit sick and depleted, and they stayed there. And so I got to that area, and I asked the Bakari Indian, the Bakari and indigenous community was in that area. I said, "Do you know Gavo's Ranch?" They said, "Oh, sure." And they took out a machete, and they led me into the forest, and they put the machete straight in the ground. And they said, "Right here." And I said, "What do you mean right here?" They said, no, it's right here." And sure enough, in that area were bricks, and they were covered by forest, and all that remained of this great ranch were bricks. And it was in that moment where I had some sense where the jungle had consumed this ranch in just a few decades. I had some sense of how remnants of a city really could disappear in the Amazon.
Meaning that there could really be something much bigger out there that had completely disappeared.
That it was really conceivable. This notion that I had seen is kind of inconceivable, you know, even though I was tempted by it and was kind of haunted by it and I found it tantalizing, it still was hard for me to imagine, like, you know, could a city disappear? Could ruins just disappear in a jungle? And when I was looking down at what the jungle and how it had ravaged this enormous place, all that remained was bricks, I really did have some inkling that, well, this was at least conceivable, this was at least possible.
You did have hopes of at least figuring out what had happened to Fawcett. Did you also hope to maybe find some evidence or confirm the existence of something like a lost city of Z?
I did. I mean, you know, with these things, you kind of, to be honest, you feel a little nuts when you're doing it because you don't know what you're going to find. And one of the themes of the book is obsession. And Fawcett became obsessed, other people became obsessed, and to be frank, I became obsessed. And I was doing things that were very unlike me. I mean, I'm not a type of person who spends any time in the wilderness. But I was very drawn by this tantalizing possibility, by this mystery, both trying to gather clues about what might happen to Fawcett. And even though I thought it was kind of a little crazy, there was still a little bit part of me that said, well, you know, could there be these ruins? Could there be something out there that was unknown, previously unknown?
In Fawcett's time, of course, he ran into all kinds of tribes that had basically never been discovered before. It had little or no contact with Europeans, cannibals. Are they still out there? Are there tribes still undiscovered, hiding?
I mean, I think I suspect that there probably are very few groups in the Amazon that haven't had at least some fleeting contact with outsiders. There are certainly tribes that the Brazilian government, for example, estimates they count, 60 tribes.
David Grand, we're going to have to take a break.
Sure.
When we come back, I want to get into some of the sort of the weird sidelights of the story. For all of Percy Fawcett being a man of science, he was also involved and interested in the occult, and I want you to tell that part of it as well. Stay with us, everyone, for more of our discussion of the Lost City of Z here on Coast to Coast AM.